that instead of no such thing as a free lunch or a struggle for existence, the vent world is a free lunch you're paid to eat. I'll show you how. What I've done here is taken the citric acid cycle compounds. They're the 11 different dots. For a couple of them, I've drawn the molecules just so you can see where they go. And on this axis, I've showed how many H2, how many electrons we add per carbon to build the molecule. So the sugars are 2 H2s per carbon, the oils are 3. And then on this axis, I've shown the energy that's used to make the molecule starting from hydrogen and CO2, because hydrogen is what the vent world provides. And actually what you see is this is a downhill run all the way to methane here at CH4. That's our greenhouse gas. So in the vent world, you are not building up complexity as a struggle against the release of energy. You're building up complexity because that's the path of least resistance to release energy. Now, the reason that matters to the citric acid cycle I showed you before is that that's what drags the cycle around. You can think of it as an old-fashioned water wheel, whereas the water flows over it, pulls the cycle around. This is the same picture. I'm not showing you the other clutter, the hydrogens and oxygens, but I show you the same molecules. And the redder a carbon atom is colored, the more oxygens it has bound to it. The bluer it's colored, the more hydrogens it has bound. So you're sliding down the hill as more of your atoms become blue and fewer of them red. This is the citric acid cycle in the same picture, where I'm showing you each of the 11 molecules with only the carbons colored. And what you can see, the cycle goes in this counterclockwise direction. In the vent world, we run it backward, the wrong way, where it makes no sense. But in the vent world, red carbon, that's carbon dioxide, comes in. And as it goes around, it gets moved toward the interior of the molecule, and electrons get added. So that process of adding electrons and using the available free energy drags the cycle around in the directions that the organisms use, and then that becomes the starting material out of which they build the rest of biomass. I'll come back and show you this a little bit later in a slightly different form. So for now, the way the Earth provides a battery and the way metabolism uses it shows the essential continuity between geochemistry and biochemistry. That by itself would not be enough to judge whether the presence of life on Earth is surprising or inevitable. To answer that question, we need to do something more. And that's what requires that we reconsider what we think the living state is and what the right kind of formal model for it is. I want to argue that the way to understand, the way that makes sense of the fact that life emerged on a lifeless Earth and that it has persisted for almost 4 billion years since, is the concept of breakdown or failure. So remember that we're trying to understand a pattern of motion. Breakdown creates patterns of motion at the same time as it destroys certain patterns of structure. So things don't only fall apart. Sometimes the events become ordered even as the structures are broken. And so we have the concept that the origin of life could be a kind of collapse. And once you have a collapse, the idea that when pushed hard enough, anything will give, that brings with it the notion of necessity. Because in the world of breakdowns, the things that persist are only the things that were the favored state or the necessary state to begin with. Now, this is not an exotic idea. It turns out that it's around us all the time. The main thing you need in order to understand it is the idea of an energy flow channel. There are lots of energy flow channels in the natural world. Lightning is one. We create a plasma that's very, very, very different from the surrounding dry air, but it allows electricity to flow. We create all this organization of wall storms in a cyclone, because that transports heat from the warm oceans to the upper atmosphere. And this is not the disordered pattern of just thunderstorms or uniformly mixed air. So these things are well understood in the physical sciences already. The thing that's important to create a channel, and the reason not all things form channels, is that there needs to be feedback. Because in all of these systems, the initial stress is diffuse. The clouds have a charge spread out over a great distance, or the oceans are warm over an enormous volume, but the ice storms concentrate only in one area because that moves things more. So I'll illustrate for you dynamically with the simplest of all channels, which is just the propagation of a fracture. If you could see a fracture propagating at the atomic scale, you would see that it's a self-similar, repeating sequence of events as bond after bond breaks. The reason this is striking is that in the original crystal, there's plenty of energy in the crystal as a whole to break the bonds, but the energy is too diffuse. And so by itself, it can't concentrate to rupture a bond. The thing that causes the fracture to propagate in an orderly way instead of happening at random everywhere is that the stress field in the surround, as it deforms, pulls the stress from the bulk back down to atomic diameters and concentrates it. This is what hydrothermal vents are doing for the Earth battery, because the battery is accumulating over the entire atmosphere and interior, but it's being focused at the regions where rock contacts water and the regions where the altered water remixes with seawater. Now I want to show you that this is actually what the citric acid cycle does within chemistry. It performs a second kind of concentration. So as the molecule goes around, it pulls in carbon, and then here it splits, and both parts go back into the cycle. So where you had one, you now have two. That's the mathematics of compound interest. And so you can exponentially grow, and you concentrate material within the cycle. Also, like compound interest on an endowment, you can pull molecules off of this to make your major classes of biological matter, but the material in the cycle is still available to serve as a kind of flypaper that continues to pull carbon in over and over again. So this is the second concentration. Now the thing, this leads to an important way of thinking about the nature of life. You could imagine that the optimization of this cycle was something carried out by evolution later, but I think there's actually a better way to view it. This cycle is self-amplifying. It works from the environmental sources of carbon. It works from the Earth's sources of electrons, and everything in the biosphere is made from it. The biosphere is what you can make if these are the compounds you have. And so this is why it becomes the core that organizes the whole rest of metabolism. So does this give us a complete theory of origins? Not nearly. There's a lot of work to be done. There are many problems to be solved, and maybe many generations, maybe centuries of work before we have a satisfactory theory the way we have a theory of matter. But it fundamentally changes the way we ask questions. When Darwin was trying to understand the origin of the world, even though he was a consummate ecologist, he emphasized organisms because that was where he could say something concrete about the action selection. His problem was to understand the patterns of relation, the fact that some things are more similar to each other than they are to others. And that was what led him to the importance of the tree of descent, the idea that the degree of similarity could be understood in terms of how long ago you had a common ancestor. But organisms, as we said, are very complicated. And the tree of descent doesn't seem to do a very good job of explaining how you ever arrive at that level of complexity. This is the point that Jerry raised in the introduction, that what organisms are is both part of the living biosphere, but they're also individual, and those are two different things. Today, we would separate the problems, and I would say we ask the same question the following way. We recognize that being an organism, or being a virus, or being a gene, or being a cell in an organism, is just one of many kinds of individuality. And these forms of individuality almost condense like dew from a kind of a background of chemical regularity, and that regularity is being carried by the ecosystem. But like dew, which doesn't condense everywhere, the forms of individuality condense where they have paths of least resistance laid down that make it easy. And so the important point about all of the concentrating mechanisms in organic chemistry, the cycles in metabolism, the Earth's battery, these define the paths of least resistance. So we can come finally back to the question of chance and necessity. There are two sort of classic pronouncements, each made by a major and truly great scientist, that reflect exactly opposite points of view. Jacques Monod worked on bacterial regulation and was one of the discoverers of how this works. His view from all of the complexity of genetics and genomic regulation was that life could be understood in terms of scientific principles, but there was no hope of predicting. He envisioned the trajectory of the biosphere through history as a kind of a random walk, where even the major steps could not have been foreseen. Christian de Duve took exactly the opposite point of view in a way that's very subtle and I think gets missed by many people. De Duve recognized, of course, that the assembly of a modern cell would only be possible with selection, because there are so many choices, they have to be selected at each range. But he went on to say something more delicate. He said, even the problem of producing the choices that selection can act on is so complicated, it's very difficult to understand how that could happen in a process where everything is equally probable. And this was what led him to propose that the success of the evolutionary game, as he puts it, was written into the fabric of the universe. What I've wanted to show you in the earlier parts of this talk is where in chemistry and in the properties of our planet those choices were laid down. So I have many people that I need to thank for this. I absolutely want to thank Jerry not only for the privilege of giving you this talk, but for supporting my work and the work of my collaborators for more than a decade. I want to thank a friend, William Melton, who supported us through the last 2 years in which this book was brought to completion, and Jerry also supported me during that time. Of course, the National Science Foundation for bringing the community together, and the three places. Yeah, most importantly, Santa Fe Institute, that were home for so many years. Yes, please. No, the oxygen is being left behind. I should stand where I'm expected. The oxygen is being left behind. So what you're doing is you're losing oceans, but you're only losing the hydrogen part of the oceans. Good?
Yes, but are we also gaining anything from the solar wind?
Some, but probably not a lot. We're not gaining water. We might... I don't know, it's a great question. I don't know what the rate of gain of hydrogen is from the solar wind quantitatively. I know it's less than the rate of loss, but I don't know by an order of magnitude how much less. Thank you. Good. In the back, yes, please.
So you're likely familiar with the debates on whether viruses are considered alive or not. I imagine, at least I've heard of cases where a virus can be as simple as just a replicating molecule like RNA or DNA surrounded by a protein coat, not doing anything like metabolism. So do you think that means it is not alive?
Great. Yeah, lovely question. I'm going to answer that by saying that the whole question turns out to use a form of English that's not meaningful. In the following sense. So here's a little bit of logical semantics. Work with me and tell me if this works for you. If I use the term living thing, a thing is a noun. Living is a predicate, right? What that means is I imagine that I can take the whole world of things, which are fundamental, and I can divide them into two sets, the living ones and the non-living ones. But if things are not fundamental, and if life is not a property inherent in things, then the whole notion living thing is a set of words. They satisfy the rules of syntax, but it's not clear they actually mean anything. So what happens if the property of being alive is defined by participating in the order of the biosphere, all the things that build it up, all those that break it down, and what we're seeing in cells and viruses is a form of individuality? Now I say, is a virus one of the forms of individuality in its life cycle when it's just RNA in a coat? Absolutely. And we can talk scientifically about what's special about that form, what makes it different from a cell. But I don't ever ask the question, is the virus alive or not? Because the virus is part of the biosphere, and it partakes of the character of the living state from the biosphere as a whole. So that's a little bit heavy as a way to answer a very good question, but I think it's the answer that will stand the test of time. I'll come right back to you. Yes?
I read there are some, you know, at the Big Bang, at the beginning of that kind of life, that what preceded it was a consciousness or the idea for the universe to grow. So could you apply that to what you're talking about here, that there was a consciousness that helps to move this or create the origins of life and create, you know, a place for that life to grow?
That's not a language I have the ability to use in any comfortable way. In a very particular sense, right? I could say that once a snowflake is formed by commonplace processes, we can talk about aspects of the pattern that makes one snowflake different from another. And in a similar sense, I can go through the emergence of life on a planet, and then organisms, and then nervous systems, and somewhere late, I have these incredibly complicated patterns that we just barely understand. And for me, it's natural to look for consciousness as a character of patterns at that late level. But in the same sense as I would not ask whether something about the snowflake was before the properties of water because it seems to be at the wrong end, I'm not able to use a language that puts consciousness at the low level.
As a form of non-physical energy, we talk a lot about physical energies, but we don't talk about non-physical energies, and consciousness could be considered, if it's thought of that way, then it predates everything. Doesn't come after the snowflake, comes before the snowflake. No, you know, anyway, I just wonder if these kind of, the sciences don't all kind of talk with each other, and I think there's some ways where they can, where there is interdisciplinary study there. I'm just questioning.
I think it's wonderful that you ask. I think it's a right conversation to have. I think it's very hard to talk and to listen both. And I will admit that my view is pretty much a mechanics view of a great many things, and perhaps that limits the set of things I can say.
Well, I think you have largely answered the question I was going to ask, and it is indeed the idea. I understand how you followed this path of metabolism of energy into living forms as a necessity, and how it comes to be, and that hypothesis is new to me. But I'm missing the same thing: the difference between the rock and organic and inorganic, inorganic carbon and carbon. Whether or not what we've always called the life cycle or the carbon cycle, the things you learn in chemistry. The particular properties that tell us whether or not the energy is living or non-living in that whole origin and metabolism. Have you given any thought to that? I think you've already answered it in the last thing you said, but what are your own thoughts about that? And do you have any idea of using the scientific method to try to discern that?
Good. So that has some words in it that I can address because I know how to use them carefully. The notion of energy is one that we have struggled tremendously to get clear for the last 250 years. And one of the great triumphs, I think, of a unification in science is that energy is energy. And so it's precisely because the role of energy in the non-living world and in the living world is the same role that we can understand how the living world embeds in the non-living world. And so that's not a place where I think it's correct to look for differences. I think humans are great at, when they haven't seen something, imagining something different from the truth. Paths of least resistance and failure modes are incredibly complicated, and we've only figured out a few of them. I think there's huge scientific mileage in learning how to do that in the domains of dynamics and of chemistry, where we're just babies. We've only begun to form science in those domains.
Does every hydrothermal vent have life associated with it? And are the chemistries the same across all those different vents? So they've all been created de novo, but all been the same.
Superb question. Yes, no, and no. No. If I could give you an hour-long talk on only this one subject in a university department, the things I would tell you. So first thing to realize, there is no place we have ever drilled, dived, or flown in the Earth that we have not found life, which is one of the reasons it's so hard to understand origin, because everything has been colonized by somebody modern. So not only does every vent have life in it, every mineshaft hole has life in it, everything that gets blown up from the subsurface in a volcano winds up having life in it. So there's life everywhere. There is certainly life that is uniquely hosted by the energy at vents. But your next question is wonderfully perceptive because it is not all the same. The vent chemistry is not all the same, and the life that they host tracks that vent chemistry quite in detail. So the vents that I showed you are the charismatic ones. Let me give you a two-line thing about geology. I told you that the deep rock in the Earth has mostly this iron 2 plus character to it. When it comes up, it gets oxidized. That's the process of converting what's called mantle into crust. Normally, you don't see mantle on the surface. You only see crust on the surface. And the magmas that make crust, when they interact with water, they create these black smokers that are full of metals, and they have a very acidic pH, 2 or 3. In rare cases, you can actually get some of the material that's supposed to be protected down below exposed on the surface. It can be stripped off by faulting. The picture I showed you of the lithosphere is Oman. It's a place where continent formation actually causes it to be shoved up on the surface of dry land. In those areas, it turns out you do not produce acidic vents. You produce alkaline vents, and you produce enormous amounts of hydrogen. If I showed you the undersea version of those, they do not have black smoke because without acid, they don't dissolve metals. They don't dissolve sulfide. Instead, they're white and shimmery, and they produce carbonate chimneys in today's oceans. If you looked at those, you would not find tube worms. You would not find crabs or snails or clams or shrimp. You would find only bacteria and archaea. So it would be a very dull picture compared to the one I showed you. But it's enormously important because it turns out, I think the reason, and there's so many things I didn't tell you about even the black smoker world. In spite of the fact that they live on a tiny energy budget far from the sun, those tube worms are actually the fastest grown organisms known. That's the fastest production of biomass of any known system. And I think the reason for that is that we need metals to live, and that's what those vents are producing in profusion. Without the metals, you go into a much sort of more miserly mode of life, where only the most conservative bacteria and archaea can make it. But thank you. And we have a couple people here on the site too. Yes.
What do you think of the theory of panspermia as a cause of life, and could you define it for the audience?
Yes, with pleasure. Good. So panspermia was the idea that, in the non-polemical form, life may not have originated on Earth, it may have originated somewhere else and been transported to Earth. Now, the polemical form, it's really hard to understand how life originated on Earth, and we only had 4.5 billion years to do it. The universe is 13 billion years old, so that's more than a factor of 2. Maybe if we had the whole universe, we'd have more time. Now, that was the old-fashioned version, sort of the 1970s version. There are more modern and more sophisticated versions where people say that some of the things about the electron battery that I showed you are actually stronger on Mars than they are on Earth, and some of the properties of water may have been easier early on. Those are very technical arguments, and I don't know how to evaluate them. I consider those to be the most plausible arguments that there could be important chemistry relevant to the origin of life that could be on a planet other than our own, where the life evolved to some significant degree of complexity and was then transported here. For my own preference, I regard those with suspicion, because I think when we find something difficult, we probably say, oh, that must mean it's impossible. And our understanding is too primitive to draw a conclusion like that at this point. We understand how hard it is to make life on Earth precisely because we understand the chemistry of life on Earth so well. And so is it sensible to go someplace where we understand the chemistry less well, where we have to rely on transport through space to deliver? But then here's the most important thing. If you think my argument has any validity, that we should look at life as a breakdown process so that only the only things that persist are the things that were the native state anyway and you just had to get to them. If life on Earth was not the native state to get into and it was a more native state somewhere else, then why would it have been a robust thing to build it there and transport it here? Why would it have survived here for 4 billion years without interruption if it was not a thing that would natively form here? Now, that's not strong enough to be a science argument, and I understand its weakness, but that direction is the drift of my not worrying a lot about panspermia.
Do you agree to the theories of George Wald, who said that life came from an electric strike like lightning that hit the elements, the Earth's primordial atmosphere, and life evolved from that? Those experiments where amino acids evolved into proteins and life form. Do you agree with those theories?
I would not repeat them in the way their original investigators believed them to be true. Again, to speak a little bit carefully, lightning strikes turn out to matter on Earth because they do something very difficult. They take N2, which is a very strong molecule, and they break it up into the forms of nitrogen that wind up being chemically interesting. That may matter, but I think it only matters at the scale of the whole planetary dynamic. The chemistry of the atmospheres is extremely different from the chemistry of life. You remember I said that chemistry in water is very restrictive and there are a lot of things that you can't do with it. The chemistry of carbon and of metals in the deep subsurface is incredibly similar to our biochemistry, so much so that you can look at enzymes that use metals and they use them as if they had just taken a mineral center and learned how to harness it for certain types of jobs. Those things were not known when George Wald was writing these things, and I think a lot of the opinions you're talking about come more from Stanley Miller and the followers of Stanley Miller after 1953. His experiments were groundbreaking, but there are two ways you can interpret them. One, you could suppose that those experiments were good models for the origin of life. That, I think, doesn't hold up so well now, though there are still many people who would disagree with me. But what you could say instead is, if chemistry in the atmosphere that's so different from biochemistry led to amino acids, many of which are the same as those in biochemistry, what should we be learning about the paths of least resistance in organic chemistry that can cause very different starting points to collapse into a few paths? And then, kind of like trees growing along the waterways in the desert, does biochemistry use the chemicals it does because it's following those paths of least resistance, even if we learned about them in the wrong environment? And there's somebody who really wants to ask another question, and I don't want to cut him off. Okay, so you will be the last one. You've had your hand up three or four times.
No. I'm almost embarrassed to stand up, considering the quality of all the questions here. But as a practical matter, we are so familiar with the term climate change and what's happening in climate change. Is mankind doing anything relative to climate change that would affect your theories in any way, shape, or form? Or are they two completely different subjects?
I'm so glad that you got a chance to ask, because it would have been a shame not to hear. I don't think that the things that people are doing affect the theories, but I would like this work to affect the things that people do. So this was the point that Jerry opened with. In biology, too much, we have put ecosystem sensibility kind of in the periphery, and we focused on organisms. And when we interact with the natural world, whether we do it industrially or agronomically, we try to engineer organisms, and we try to influence systems with a few components as if we were building a watch or a bridge. And routinely, it winds up putting us in places where we don't want to be or where we shouldn't want to be. If biology can anchor ecology more centrally and start to understand the regression of ecosystems towards certain patterns that it's very hard to pull them away from, maybe biology can help us head off misunderstandings in the world of application and make us a little bit more intelligent, or in some cases a little bit more precautionary about what we do. Biology as a science is sound, but biology as a science is not always proactive enough to anticipate the mistakes people are going to make. A more ecological biology may prime us to be a little bit better at second-guessing the things that can go wrong and trying to be careful ahead of time.
This is Aspen Public Radio. You've been listening to New Theories on the Origin of Life with Dr. Eric Smith, a live broadcast from the McCloskey Speaker Series. Support for the McCloskey Speaker Series comes from Penny Evans Carruth with Aspen Snowmass Sotheby's, opening doors for buyers and sellers in the Roaring Fork Valley. Learn more at 379-9133. This talk and all of our coverage of the Aspen Institute's McCloskey Speaker Series can be found on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Allison Bektesh, Aspen Public Radio News. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale. Your news, your music, your station.